On the day the Twin Towers came down, I hardly left my television set. Over and over again, I watched the plane make its graceful turn and plow a fiery furrow through the second tower. Over and over again, I watched each tower slide down upon itself. Over and over again, I watched New Yorkers running ahead of clouds of crashing debris pursuing them through the streets. And over again, I saw Harry running, his head snapping back and forth in quick glances over his shoulder to see how fast the cloud was gaining on him. By the end of the day, of course, I realized the man caught on film was too short and too young to be Harry, who is over 50 by now. I'd had another of my sightings of Harry, tricks of memory and imagination that have haunted me for over a decade. I imagine that I see Harry in the photo of a crowd on the back page of a newspaper or on the television news, watching a building burning or standing by the side of a derailed train in Arizona or Madrid. In my first look at a video of a rescue of lost hikers in the woods, I scan a face that looks like Harry's. I even listen carefully for the names of miners buried in accidents in Utah or Bolivia. Of course, it is never Harry, but I never stop seeing something of Harry in every scene of disaster. Harry's own disaster was minor, local, generally forgotten. Few people knew or remember Harry at all. He was forgotten twice, when he left Berkeley in 1969, and again when he left even more dramatically in 1989. Only I have tangible reminders of him in my garage, a box of his classroom papers, his attempts at a novel, a few letters. Still, I'm probably the wrong person to write Harry's story. I suppose these repeated sightings of him are simply my unconscious reminders to myself that if I don't write it, no one else will.
Those are the opening words of The Berkeley Pit, a splendid new work by the prolific writer Dorothy Bryant. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host for A Novel Idea. My guest in the studio is J.J. Wilson, Professor Emeritus of English from Sonoma State University and a longtime friend of Dorothy Bryant. And Dorothy will join us in a phone interview later in the broadcast.
Hi, Rosemary.
J.J., I'm so glad to have you here.
Thank you.
And I'm indebted to you also for opening your archives so that I could become acquainted with this remarkable writer who I believe has lived in Berkeley for 50 years. When did you first come to know Dorothy Bryant and her work?
Well, it was after the writing of Ella Price's Journal, the first published novel that was of such interest to us here, because it was really one of the first things I had ever read that gave the feeling of teaching as transformation, which is something that we were all trying to do, after all, 60s, 70s, 80s, right straight on. And this, in this journal, the woman who is a re-entry student, as we now know to call them, but at the time, this was 1972, it was a voice not heard from before. Also, there were no books about community colleges. They tended to be, even if the people were, you know, thinking of the community college, the editors told them to recast them as four-year or six-year colleges. And, you know, most of the people in the world go to community colleges, really.
That's right.
So there's a lot of stories there.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking as I heard Suzanne's beautiful entry into the reading of the novel, The Berkeley Pit, that is very much what Ruth is doing, is very much what Dorothy has done. She's written the stories no one else will write.
Mm-hmm. I do find a close association with Dorothy and with her her narrator in the book, Ruth Carson. I want to give just a bit of biographical information about Dorothy. She was born in San Francisco, graduated from San Francisco State University with a degree in music, and taught music and English in high schools, colleges, and universities. She's published at least 34 books. 34 books. Imagine. Novels, plays, essays, as well as a how-to book called Writing a Novel. And she's won many honors for her work. The variety of her work makes it hard to categorize, and she rejects labels. She says, Italian-American writers is one of several labels that, at one time or another, was attached to me, like woman writer, feminist writer, Bay Area writer, California writer, working class writer, and so on. I am all of these things when I draw on experience denoted by them, and none of these things when anyone attempts to confine me with a label. I love that quotation from Dorothy. And you wrote about Dorothy Bryant in an Encyclopedia of Feminist Writers. Would you tell us a bit about what you said there about Dorothy?
Well, I wrote it for that very reason, that I was afraid otherwise she wouldn't get in the book. And I wanted very much for her to be there. I noticed, for instance, there's not a real Wikipedia essay on Dorothy Bryant, and that's something that ought to be done, so that we can't overlook all this 34 books and a life of a noble, dedicated life of writing. But I think what I wrote there now seems almost out of date. It seems, it was very much of its time. And Dorothy goes on growing and changing, and her books go on changing. So perhaps what would be most interesting for me here is to say, what would I change if I had to rewrite it? I hope I don't, but if I were rewriting it. And I would probably say that I understand better now, I made so much emphasis upon each of the books being a drastic departure from the last book. Now I understand it's really all the same book. They are always writing. Dorothy is always writing about the transformation of the personality, the myth seen side by side with current events. There's usually a fire, there's often classroom scenes.
Yes.
There's always some other form caught within it, that wonderful letter from his mother, the Berkeley Pit, touched me very much. Anyway, I don't know whether this will be of interest to the radio audience, because not all of you have had the chance to read all of Dorothy's books all the way through several times, as I have. And I now see their unity, and I am impressed by it.
Yes. She is rational and moderate in her writing and interviews, and she's caused some readers to react with a lot of emotion, and some might label her as controversial. But she's in good company there when you speak truth to power that's unsettling to many people.
You know, if there is a problem with Dorothy's prescience, it is that she's just a little bit ahead of when everybody else catches on. Mm-hmm. And so there is a Cassandra element in a way, mm-hmm. that people do react to being told that something that they thought was just all set and wonderful and liberating and all that is actually one more myth to lie by.
Yes.
Which is the name of one of her collections of essays, instead of myths to live by.
Yes.
She felt that we cover up a lot of our truest feelings often by a kind of, I don't want to say false, but a kind of too convincing narrative. And, man, she just stickers them. It's wonderful.
And before we get to her latest novel, The Berkeley Pit, I want to spend a few minutes on a couple of her earlier works. Our listeners may not be familiar with them, but one of her best-known novels is The Kin of Atta Are Waiting for You. Alice Walker said this is one of her favorite books in all the world. Would you call it a fantasy, an allegory? Here I'm asking for categories, my goodness.
Also, I have to say, Rosemary, I love your questions usually, but I saw this one, I thought, this is the dumbest darn question. It's both, of course. But what it really is a utopia. Excuse me. It is I'm speaking truth to power here. I'm going to be in trouble, you all. But anyway, it is a utopian novel, and best to see that way. And I found a wonderful quote from it, really brief. I wonder if you all will let me just read it.
Of course.
Here's this great thing. After we dumped the jobs telling people what to do, which was counting money and moving it about, making people do what they don't want, or bashing them for doing what they want, we have lots of people to work. Kids work. Old folks work. Women and men work. With most everybody, it's part-time. Nobody breaks their back and grubs dawn till dusk. Now, that is a utopian vision of the distribution of labor in a society that isn't beset by status. And when people start writing like that, it really helps us think outside of categories.
Yes, it does.
I love that.
Yes. And it's a wonderful book. The name of that one is The Kin of Atta Are Waiting for You. And I'll repeat the titles of the books that we're talking about several times during the program.
I have to tell one funny story.
Go for it.
It was known almost they thought nobody knew about the book much until Bob Bryant, driving along, saw a license plate that said Kin of Atta. Kin Atta, I think it was. I'm trying to get the right number of figures. And he was fascinated, and so he followed it. He thought he had to find out who, and he followed it up the Berkeley Hills into the Theological Institute, into a churchyard. It was the minister of a church, and everyone in the church had read the Kin of Atta and discussed it, and it was part of their whole practice. And wasn't that a one?
What
wouldn't
a
you
great
love,
story.
Love to see the title of your book on a license plate. That's pretty cool.
Wonderful. Another of her best-known books is a historical novel, The Confessions of Madame Psyche. A reviewer wrote that the heroine, Mei Li, is exposed to, quote, nearly every experience available to a female protagonist in the 20th century, unquote. Isn't that an amazing summary of the life of Mei Li?
Not even hyperbolic.
That's
amazing.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right. And that was an award-winning book. And
I think the local angle here that's so fascinating for people is that one of her it's a Psyche and Aerosmith writ large, and her descent into hell is when she goes to the Napa mental hospital. And Dorothy went there to find out all the details of how they do their business there and where they bury the people and so forth. And she worked with a wonderful archivist there. And it is still the most accurate account we have of what went on in that hospital. And so many people here have worked there. And it's part that is very local and very interesting. But she documents so much of California history in the Central Valley, other places too, in that book.
Yes, and that was one of the most amazing parts of that book when Mei Li is confined in the hospital. And the name of that one is The Confessions of Madame Psyche. Now, our listeners will have caught on by now that Dorothy Bryant doesn't keep writing the same book over and over, although, as J.J. has pointed out, there is a common, perhaps theme is not the best word, that runs through it. But I think the book that caused the greatest stir was called A Day in San Francisco, a very personal and painfully prophetic novel about Gay Freedom Day celebration in 1980. In discussing the book, Dorothy Bryant said, "It seemed to me more and more incredible that we liberals in the Bay Area, gay and straight, young and old, lived in a state of denial approaching delusion and silence approaching lies." And so she addressed the issues as she saw them, and she received some scathing negative reviews and hate mail, and some bookstores and librarians boycotted her work. Dorothy has some very interesting things to say about censorship, and you and I have heard her talk on this subject from her own personal experience. And you brought to my attention a website called Literary Lynching, a column by Pat Holt. And I found that simply by Googling literary lynching in quotation marks, If you put quotation marks around literary lynching and Google it on the web, it'll take you straight to that column. And you can read Pat Holt's words about the censorship of the book.
Also, it's Dorothy's manuscript on literary lynchings, which I believe is 7 or 8 chapters on individual authors who've been really terribly damaged by misreadings of their books, is there. It was very interesting to publish it online, as Pat Holt was brave to do and a good supportive friend to do. The last chapter is about what Dorothy went through with a day in San Francisco. You understand that it was about you understand, of course, but I want the readers to know that it was about the unhealthy lifestyle that she thought. And this was before AIDS had been diagnosed or defined. And so it was too true too soon, you know. Yes. Now there's much less criticism of the book because it's generally accepted.
Well, again, she was ahead of her time.
Yeah, that's what
and
I mean.
She was accused of homophobia, which is the last thing that she was guilty of. But people didn't accept. Well, again, it's the Cassandra thing, isn't it? She sees what's ahead, and people don't want to hear it, and so they blame her for voicing that.
I think it's the shoot the messenger, you know. You just can't bear the message, so
yes.
You take it out on the messenger.
Mm-hmm. In a review written at the time in the Washington Times, Joanne Greenberg wrote that Bryant's readership felt betrayed and compared the situation of George Orwell's publication of, Homage to Catalonia, and Jack London's John Barleycorn. And then Miss Greenberg goes on to say, Miss Bryant seemed serenely unconscious of her critics, and it wasn't until I wrote to her and asked about the book's reception that she spoke of the effects professionally and personally that its appearance occasioned. Most writers sulk or fume in such circumstances. Orwell turned to writing fiction. London went quiet. Miss Bryant went on. Isn't that
wonderful? Now, you know Joanne Greenberg is the author of I Never Promised You a Rose Garden and many other books, too.
Oh, I'd forgotten that.
Isn't that great?
Of
and
course.
They are very good friends, Dorothy and Joanne, and they have a correspondence with one another.
Yes.
That I hope someday will be published, because for one thing, it's kind of funny.
That would be lovely to see it published.
I agree.
Yeah, perhaps it'll happen. And we are so grateful that Dorothy Bryant did go on. For in addition to her many other books that she produced, what I think of as her magnum opus, I hope she doesn't mind if I describe it that way, The Berkeley Pit. Now, in a few minutes, we're going to get Dorothy herself on the line, but first I want to talk with you a bit about the beauty of the book itself. It's one of the most beautiful books I've seen in a long time. And I think a great deal of credit goes to her publisher. Well, a great deal of credit goes to Dorothy for writing the book. And then her publisher, Clark City Press. It's a small publishing house. Is that right?
Yes. They don't do a lot of work. No.
Uh-huh. And they're very choosy.
Absolutely.
About what they
have excellent taste.
Yeah. And they, since they're small and choosy, they maintain control over every item of the book, the print, the paper. It's on beautiful paper. It's such a pleasure to hold a book that's beautifully put together, that the type is large enough that you can read it without strain, and there's quite a bit more white space than I recall seeing on many contemporary books.
Rosemary, you've said it so well, I don't even need to parlay on it, except to say that Don Emblem, who many of you all know is a printer here, as well as a poet, and he just cannot get over the quality of the book, of the actual publishing. And I think it reminds us how much ground we've lost, in a way, in the printing of books nowadays.
That's what I thought of when I was reading the book. I thought, this is a wonderful book to hold, and if only all books were treated as carefully and with such reverence almost, mm-hmm. As this book. The cover is quite beautiful. White feathers floating on a kind of a murky background. The publisher said that his original idea was to, since it is a tale of two cities, Berkeley in California and Butte in Montana, was to have the Campanile at Berkeley on the cover, along with one of the less attractive parts of the copper mine in Butte. But he said it just didn't work out. And then I don't remember if the publisher, if it was Dorothy, came up with the idea of the feathers floating. And the story is, of course, that this huge open pit mine in Butte is no longer a working mine and is filled up with a toxic soup. And if birds land on it, they don't survive to take off again. So it's the sadness of these beautiful white feathers floating on this poisonous liquid in this open pit mine.
I want to just say that the work they did on the cover of the book is by such beautiful contrast to the awful time Dorothy had when they reprinted Ella Price's journal in a paperback, the publisher Signet did, with an absolutely revolting sort of erotic negligee scene that had nothing to do whatever with the interior of the book. And Dorothy was so outraged. That was part of the impetus to start a publishing house of her own, which is called Atta Press, by the way, after Kinavata. And therefore her books are still in print, you know.
Yes, and some of the books that she self-published were then picked up by other publishing houses. And so I don't know if those are still in print or not.
They are. The Feminist Press never takes things out of print. That's one of the wonderful things about them. And they have four, I think, of her works with up-to-date introductions by scholars. Yeah. So it's there. That's a good way to get the books, too.
You're listening to A Novel Idea. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host. With me in the studio is J.J. Wilson. The book we are discussing is called The Berkeley Pit by Dorothy Bryant. And in just a few minutes, we're going to have a telephone interview with Dorothy, who's patiently waiting for us to get around to talking with her. a little bit more, though, about the publisher. I don't remember ever reading in any book a note from a publisher as the preface to the book, and I certainly don't remember one as laudatory as this. He talks about, the book came in over the transom, as they say. That means she sent it in, what would you say, on spec?
Unsolicited. Mm-hmm. Two chapters.
And the publisher was so excited that he immediately asked for more and got in touch with Dorothy. But when you read the book and you read the note from the publisher, let me read a little bit to show you his excitement. Reading these chapters was like being stung on the point of the nose by an especially large bumblebee. I couldn't believe it, and my initial response was an almost twisted sense of denial that this could be. Nothing this tight and powerful could possibly simply appear in the mail. But there was not a shadow of a doubt in my mind that the serving I had just tasted was quite out of the ordinary, and I couldn't get to the phone fast enough to order the whole pudding. When it came, I devoured it in one long, incredulous sitting. He writes very well himself. Yes, I'm just charmed with what he has to say.
And I love that he says, I didn't even know who Dorothy Bryant was, I'm embarrassed to say. What a thought, you know, that maybe all over this country there are people writing like Dorothy whom we just don't. Or when I say like Dorothy, you know what I mean, with equal bodies of work, whom we just don't know.
Yes, I'm sure that's true.
So I like being able to talk about her on your program, Rosemary.
I know. I like being able to talk about her as well. One more bit from the publisher. This is the closing of his prelude to the book. Produced in the autumn of a brilliant and noble career, This novel is by turns sympathetic, generous, often deliciously witty, intuitive, understanding, and perhaps most of all compassionate. In all respects, a luminous example of mature literary authorship by one of our most genuine national treasures. Discovering Dorothy Bryant was a revelation, something perhaps like having never known Franz Schubert lived, and then accidentally hearing the Ave Maria. My life has been enriched and changed forever. It's by Russell Chatham of Livingston, Montana. Now that is praise to die for, isn't it? And certainly merited. But it just, you know, it brings tears to my eyes to think of such appreciation for the effort that she put into this book. Yes. We're going to take a short break. You're listening to A Novel Idea. This is Rosemary Manchester. With me in the studio is J.J. Wilson. The book we are discussing is The Berkeley Pit by Dorothy Bryant. And in just a moment, we will go to a phone interview with Dorothy Bryant herself. We'll be right back.
Rows and flows of angel hair and ice cream castles in the air and feather canyons everywhere. I've looked at clouds that way, but now they only block the sun. They rain and they snow on everyone. So many things I would have done, but clouds got in my way. I've looked at clouds from both sides now, from up and down, and still somehow it's cloud illusions that I recall. I really don't. Dancing way you feel as every fairy tale comes real. I looked at love that way once upon a time, but now it's just another show. You leave them laughing when you go, and if you care, don't let them know. No, don't give yourself away. I've looked at love from both sides now, from give and take and steal.
You're listening to A Novel Idea. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host. J.J. Wilson is in the studio with me. We've been talking about Dorothy Bryant and her book, The Berkeley Pit. And in just a moment, we're going to be talking with Dorothy. But I want to take just a minute to introduce her characters, and then I'll ask Dorothy to say more about them. The narrator of the book, Ruth Carson, teaches English at Merritt College in Oakland. The book takes place during the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, and Ruth Carson, the narrator, is an observer of the events that tear Berkeley apart. And I'm calling Harry Lynch the protagonist because one of the reviewers did that, and it seemed to make sense to me. He's a young man who's a student of hers, and in the beginning of the book, he gives her a poem he has written that describes a nightmare of a mine in Butte, Montana. The mine is called the Berkeley Pit, and his Italian ancestors worked at that mine, his grandmother, whom he calls Nonarina. And the two stories come together, the story of Harry Lynch and the Berkeley Pit, and the story of Ruth Carson and Berkeley, the town, come together. All right. Can we talk to Dorothy now? Dorothy, are you there?
Hi, Rosemary.
Oh, it's so good to hear your voice.
I didn't write 34 books. I mean, it's more like 24, including the plays. So if you want to inflate me that way, that's fine.
You know, I get carried away in my exuberance, and if I gave you 10 more books, why, sorry about that. But
give me something to look live up to. I have to write fast now.
If you'd like to write 10 more books, I promise that I will read and enjoy every single one of them. Yeah, but it's not an assignment.
Oh, thank you. Enough of that teacher stuff. And hi, JJ. It's nice to hear JJ. We haven't gotten together for a long time.
We will soon, dear. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Would you talk to us a bit about Ruth Carson, your narrator? Now, you and Ruth do... I'm not saying that Ruth is you, but you do...
She's much nicer than I am.
Oh! Well, she is very
nice.
You ask
JJ, she'll tell you.
But I was thinking of her career. You yourself taught at Merritt, is that correct?
No, I taught at Contra Costa College in Richmond, but it was a very similar situation.
Uh-huh.
And it was in the 60s that I began.
Yes.
And I left teaching in the mid-70s to write full-time. But
yes.
Teaching, I had been more than 25 years at it in San Francisco and in Berkeley and Richmond.
Yes. And one knows from reading the book that the person who has written this book knows a great deal about teaching. And Ruth Carson is a lovely, lovely teacher. She's so empathetic with her students, and yet she doesn't let them get away with anything that's inferior work. She encourages them to do their best. I almost would call her tough, but she's also very cool. In her observation of the events.
Yeah, that was the thing that I wanted to do with her, and I'm glad you called Harry the protagonist.
Okay.
Because some people have called Ruth the protagonist,
mm-hmm.
and I don't know whether that's true or not, but mainly I wanted Ruth as a reliable narrator to tell what happened to Harry.
Yes.
That Harry is one of the casualties of that wonderful time of upheaval, and we have instant amnesia about the casualties, the things that went wrong, and somehow that's what came to me. By the way, the reason that, you know, his family history, his Italian family history, is my family history.
Yeah.
That's how I joined the two things. My grandfathers, when they first landed in the United States, they went to work in copper mines. And if you've read Miss Giardino,
yes.
One of my novels,
yes.
The old man, the furious old man who's coughing his lungs out,
oh, yes.
The portrait of my grandfather, it was probably the strongest memory of my childhood, was being around this man. I was terrified of him. It took me years before I realized that he wasn't angry at me, but at, you know, what a bad deal he'd gotten in his hope
yes.
for America.
Yes. And do I understand that you and your husband went to Butte to do research? And
well, actually, we stumbled on it. We had gone to Yellowstone, and I said, hey, look, we're on our way back. We can't be too far from Butte. I heard about that all my life, and I know the name of the street that my father lived on with his parents, so we can go there and see if the neighborhood has changed. Well, I discovered the neighborhood had changed. It was sunk in the Berkeley pit.
It was gone.
And it was gone. It had been dug away, and here I saw this sign over this abandoned pit mine, this toxic lake thing, the Berkeley Pit. And I said, oh, what a title for a novel.
And it is.
That's how I got sucked into it. I know, the problem of combining these two parts of my life was a daunting one, but it wouldn't let me go.
Yes,
so
and in much that I've read of people who are writing about your work, the verb weaving comes in a lot, how you weave your stories. And I thought how deftly you brought the two strands of your story together in your weaving here. And it also occurred to me, you're the only person who could have written this book.
I think that's true. I think that, first of all, I was in Berkeley during this period, and I was too old to be really carried away. So I was more of an observer like Ruth as
yes.
a teacher and all. And also that experience of my, of course, many immigrant families, we're all immigrants, and many have gone through similar things, but that particular thing ending up in this, you know, the Berkeley Pit is the number one Superfund site in the country, which means it's the worst of the worst.
Oh.
And to have that background, to have that ending to the kinds of hopes that my grandparents had. Of course, they got out of Butte. They came to California. But I think partly I created Harry asking myself, what would have happened if I hadn't gotten out of Butte? I probably would, my son would have been Harry, you know, and,
oh.
and I would have had a whole different experience.
Yes. I've left it to you to tell our listeners why it's called the Berkeley Pit. I'm sure the mine, you know, the open pit, a mile wide, a mile and 600 feet deep, and full of acid and toxic stuff. Why? And do you want to tell us why it's called the Berkeley Pit?
Why the mine is called that?
Yeah. Well,
I don't know. In the book, I make very various guesses.
Yes. Well, that's what I was asking.
Yeah.
For,
right.
Your
Harry
conjecture.
Does, uh-huh. Harry does his first research paper in Ruth's class, trying to find the reason for the name the Berkeley Pit. And what I concluded was what no one else has said, that is that the city of Berkeley was named by Frederick Billings, who stood on a promontory and recited, you know, that poem
yes.
that goes, westward
yes.
flows the course of empire,
yes.
and so on. And then he said, why don't you call this town after the poet? Bishop Berkeley, call it Berkeley.
Yes.
And I thought, and Billings is the name of the largest town in Montana.
Yes.
And Billings had lumber interests and made his money from railroad interests. And he had to have been in Butte, which was the largest city at that time. It was just a huge, bustling place. He might have been in Butte one day and just decided, oh, you're digging another mine? Well, call it Berkeley. They used to name them casually.
Yes.
You know, dozens of them every day.
Yes.
So that's my story, but I have no proof at all.
No, no. And therefore, you put it in the writing of Harry.
Of Harry,
the character
yeah.
you created.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
so that he can... I think it's a wonderful... It certainly makes a lot of sense.
And yeah, it's as likely as any other explanation.
Exactly, exactly. And after all, as we point out, it is a work of fiction, historical fiction.
But the big events, as I say
oh, yes.
in the introduction,
yes.
the big events really happen.
Absolutely.
Because some of those seem to be the most incredible and,
yes.
and the most forgotten ones.
Yes.
Sometimes,
yes.
Some things we'd rather erase
yes.
from memory.
But they are so incredible that you couldn't have made that up. I mean, no novelist could have come up with the Black Panthers and Eldridge Cleaver.
Oh, yeah. Well, those,
the People's Park.
What I did was if I named somebody, if I used, and
yes.
I have plenty of real characters.
Oh, yes.
They're not central ones. The central ones
right.
are fictitious.
Yes.
But in the case of Eldridge Cleaver,
yes.
when he says something, it comes right out of something of his that I read.
Yes.
I don't put words in his mouth that he didn't use.
Yes.
And there are other people like that who are named as real figures, and most of them are dead, so I don't have to worry about getting sued. But I tried to say things that were in keeping with them.
Yes.
There were a few live real people,
yes,
that I named, like my friend Pat Cody.
Oh, yes.
Who is a great person.
Oh, yes.
Co-founder of Cody's Books back,
yes,
then. And I ran it by Pat, you know, if I said anything here that you didn't want me to say or you didn't think represented you properly. And so, you know, she said, no, go ahead, you're fine.
Yes.
So, and some things quoted from Fred Cody's letters that he wrote to relatives back east during this period. So I tried to, I mean, it's historical fiction, and but you can trust it more than you can,
yes,
some historical nonfiction, I think.
Yes, yes. I trusted it absolutely on instinct, but it's interesting to hear from hear you talk about it. The J.J. made available to me the book that Pat and Fred Cody wrote called Cody's Books.
Oh, yes.
And
wonderful.
It gave me so much insight. You know, I was living on the other coast when all this happened, and, you know, I was of an age that I was a parent and not a kid. So the whole Berkeley story is kind of news to me, and I suppose as it is to many of our listeners. And so I thoroughly enjoyed getting to know some of the background of these events, which
but
are...
But I think that some of the things that... It's not just special to Berkeley.
Ah.
What was in the air, I think, in the 60s was happening in some other places, too, in college towns and all over. It sort of reflected what was happening in France. There were student revolts and so on there.
Mm-hmm.
And so while the story happens in Berkeley, I don't think that a time of ferment like that and protest was exclusive just to Berkeley. It was going on many, many places.
No, and J.J., you probably experienced some of that at some of the
stage.
Oh,
I could smell the tear gas when I read it, yes. I was teaching, you know, there for part of it, and being a student also. I didn't understand it as well as Dorothy does.
Uh-huh.
And
well, I didn't understand too well at the time, mm-hmm, either, and I was a parent at the time, and that was a strange position to watch from, because I saw wonderful things happening and I joined protest marches and, you know, all that. At the same time, I was terrified for my kids. I didn't know what might happen because, you know, there was at the same time the rise of the drug culture and all,
yes,
kinds of stuff.
And such violence, the involvement of the military and Governor Reagan declaring martial law.
Yeah, yeah.
And the bulldozers and all that that violence going on right there. I thought you were very wise to keep your narrator as the cool observer.
Yeah, she had to be.
Yes.
The reader had to trust that we were getting the straight story, and
that's
you didn't,
right,
want somebody who was enjoying the whole thing too much.
Yes. I wanted to ask about a couple of your characters who were, I thought they were malicious. The character of Dan Lyon, speaking of people who got involved.
Yeah.
He's a fictitious character, right?
He's a fictitious,
yes,
character, but he's a kind of composite,
yes,
of a certain type of person who is drawn to disorder, who thinks that something good must be happening if you're throwing rocks and burning things down, that's the revolution coming or whatever.
Yes.
And people like that are attracted whenever anything hits the media, then they poured into Berkeley at the time. And,
yes,
and I can think of a few names of people that occasionally... that did things that I had Dan Lyon do, but yeah. I'm not going to do that because I think they're still alive.
And then you have a malicious journalist who writes under the name of Bishop Berkeley. And the feeling is that it's a woman, and she and Dan Lyon do real damage to to Harry, among other people.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you knew people who were spreading vicious gossip like that.
Yeah, the Bishop Berkeley column was a slightly exaggerated form of something that was running in the in one of the freebie weeklies here at the time. And whenever I knew anything about what the person, the writer, was referring to, I would be appalled at how irresponsible and non-factual it was.
Yes.
And yet you couldn't, you really couldn't he was so malicious, you really couldn't answer anything to correct it, because he really frightened me. I thought, he'll come down on me next.
Yes.
It was very strange. Well, he grew up and got over it, and that's gone now.
Oh, good.
I wanted to say that aside from the scenes of violence and of protest, that the book is a kind of love affair with bookstores, too, and the wonderful mm-hmm. effect that they can have in a community of the independent bookstores, and Andy, who was, after all, first here in Cotati.
Right,
and
yeah.
The wonderful bookstore Eeyore's. And when I think that now Cody's is gone, closed down, I felt a sorrow at that outcome, ultimately.
Well, that era of Telegraph Avenue, when we all hung out at the Med and then shopped for books and so on, that has been changed by a lot of things. It was injured by the way Telegraph went after the unexpected outcome of creation of People's Park, which we all demonstrated for, but nobody ever really thought it would turn out to be such a mixed blessing,
yes,
to say the least. And then the drawing of there's the economic situation, which means there are more people on the streets. There's the deinstitutionalization of places like Napa State Hospital,
yes,
which means there are more impaired people on the streets. Then the internet. We're seeing now, I think that probably hurt the bookstores more than anything, which have all been closing right and left. This new generation of students goes on the net and orders the book.
Yes.
And I don't know what they do for browsing. Maybe they don't browse. We're the last.
We're the last of the browsers.
Last of the browsers.
Yes. I was in a bookstore today, our wonderful Northlight local bookstore, and people were browsing.
Oh,
so
no,
there.
Wonderful.
Browsing lives. Dorothy, to me, the strands of the story came together. I believe it was in rereading the book, I noticed when there's a confrontation between Ruth and Harry. And I wondered if you'd read some of that. It's on page 124 in the book, and it starts 3 days later.
Yeah, I can do that.
Thank you.
And to just set this up, this is the beginnings of the of the People's Park demonstrations, a kind of struggle against the university, which took on symbolic value to a lot of people, including Harry, in his loss of his home and his grandmother and so on back in Butte. So there were a lot of different motives and a lot of heartbreak of different kinds going into it. Okay. 3 days later, the university demolished the last row of houses on the block behind Telegraph. The house where Harry, Angel, and Dan Lyon had been living was virtually empty by that time, except for a handful who had barricaded themselves in. Despite Dan Lyon's yelling and rock throwing and lying down and being dragged away by police, the bulldozers rolled. Within a couple of hours, the last five houses were piles of debris. Harry showed up at my house that night, breathless and furious, raving as if he were drunk or drugged. But there was no smell of liquor or any sign of drugs that I could recognize. They killed Nonarina the same way. I've been there. I know. That's what they do. They're here, those rotten killers. This time, we're not going to let them do it. This time, it's going to be different. This time, I sat him down and gave him a small glass of brandy and a big glass of water. Tell me what happened, Harry. You know what happened. Go up there and look. Well, the university tore down some old houses on university property. Yeah, that's all. The look he gave me was full of generalized, anguished hatred. Yeah, their property. Everything belongs to them. He gulped down the brandy. What did you say about your Nonarina? Who killed her? The same people. The company. The ones who own everything. Different names, but the same. He took a gulp of water, coughed, laughed. Whatever word could describe the furious bark that came out of his mouth. Sometimes even the names are the same. Hearst. Walk through Safer Gate and ask yourself how that got paid for. He shook his head. You don't get it. He lurched out of the chair and stood. Well, tell me about Nonarina. I thought she was in her 80s when she died. Being that old, it was only natural. He fell back into the chair. In her 80s and strong. She could have lived another 10 years, 20, if they just left her, but no. They had to take everything. All her life, she lost and lost and made do and lost again. She lost her home, her country, so she made a new one, made it on that dead mountain. Lost her family in Italy, so she made a new one here. Lost her husband, even before he was killed in the accident, she lost him when he went down the mines. It changed him. Lost her son, even before the Khan killed him. Married to a girl she was ashamed to have in her house. Lost her granddaughter to a drunk who beat her up, and then to some old crook in that order, or vice versa. Hell, I'm not sure even which one was my father. Choked and coughed, and I poured more brandy.
Oh, thanks for that reading.
That isn't what happened to my nonna. She got to California.
Yes.
But there were old people, and they started digging out for the Berkeley Pit, who were going to lose their homes, and there actually were heart attacks and suicides and all kinds of things when this pit was dug.
Yes. Yes. It's in spite of all the sadness in the book, you managed to end on a note of hope. And I was so interested in your last paragraph that they found in this noxious pit mine that there was a benign bacteria.
And that's factual.
I was sure it was.
I didn't make it.
You wouldn't have made that up.
Yeah.
And that was... another beautiful passage. When our readers get to that passage, they'll love reading it, but they'll be sad because they've come to the end of a beautiful book. So my recommendation is read it again.
That's right.
They can just turn right back to the beginning and read it right straight through. Dorothy, I want to thank you for taking the time to talk with us about your latest novel, The Berkeley Pit.
It was a pleasure.
And JJ and I thank you for writing this important book.
Yeah. Hope we haven't worn you out, Dorothy.
Okay. And I want to remind our listeners of your other books, the ones that we've highlighted here, The Kin of Atta, The Confessions of Madame Psyche, and A Day in San Francisco.
And if they want to go on my website, DorothyBryant.com, it lists all the books and the plays. So
and with wonderful descriptions next to them, too. It's very well done. I was impressed by it.
Thanks for reminding me about the website.
The website. We're all high-tech now.
Yeah. And Dorothy Bryant is going to be here for the Sonoma County Book Festival on Saturday, September 20th, in downtown Santa Rosa, so you can meet Dorothy. She will read from the Berkeley Pit and answer your questions about her work. Her books will be for sale, and she'll sign them for you. So put that date on your calendar, Saturday, September 20th. For more information about the book festival, you can consult that website, SoCo Book Fest. And your literary team here at KRCB is working on the program for the book festival. Gil Mansurg and I are serving on the authors committee. Catherine Hastings is working her magic, bringing in poets from all over the country. It's going to be a fabulous day. And JJ has information about a special event to benefit the book festival. JJ?
Well, you know that we always try to have a wonderful events running up to the book festival.
Yes.
And we, while the book festival is all free that whole day, they charge for the hot dogs, I understand, in the square, but otherwise it's all free. And we do it by having benefits that are not all free. And we found a marvelous way to celebrate this time and to get a little money out of people, and that is to ask you to come hear John Ash, the iconic, marvelous John Ash, a Sonoma County chef. And aside from his teaching, which is phenomenal, he's just gotten a big award for it, and his radio programs on a radio station, I won't mention competitor here, and he's also written a lot of books. And his wonderful From the Earth to the Table, John Ash's Wine Country Cuisine, has just been reissued, 45 new recipes, everything updated, and he'll be signing it. So it's part of the series on Cooks with Books that we love to do. And it's being held at a marvelous farm on Chileno Valley Road, beautiful part of the county, just west of Petaluma. To find out more details about it, please call me. I'm going to give my phone number if that's all right.
Of course.
And also my email, because I too am high tech that far. JJ Wilson, 795-9028. And my email is boxcar, BOXCAR. There's a story behind that. I'll tell you if you call me. boxcar@sonic.net. And I can give you the directions. The date is Saturday, August the 9th, from 2 to 5. The best part, maybe the dessert I saved to last. Sarah Baker is going to be doing the live music before and after John speaks with us. John Ash, I hope to see you there. It's a wonderful way to support your book festival and eat some homemade marvelous pizza and gingerbread and all kinds of good things and watch the llamas and goats and sheep.
Now, that is truly a wonderful event on August 9th, and I hope to see many of you there. And when you come, tell us that you heard about it on KRCB.
We'll give you a discount.
Okay, next month you'll hear from another author who will be at the book festival. James Tipton will be here to talk about his novel, Annette Vallon. James teaches English at the College of Marin and Santa Rosa Junior College. This is his first novel, and it's a beauty. So we'll be here again next month. And in the meantime, remember, there's no such thing as too many books.
You've been listening to A Novel Idea here on KRCB. You can tune in every Wednesday at 7 for literary programming. Coming up next, Doug Jane and Connections. Stay tuned.